Governor Mills and Dr. Nirav Shah on the latest with COVID-19 in Maine. While schools are closed, stores and restaurants are shuttered, and all of Maine is staying home, Maine's COVID-19 numbers continue to rise. Public health officials here have begun to learn more about how the pandemic is spreading in Maine. Some cases have been traced to a traveling salesperson. Others are clusters within families. But there are still many questions. Among them, will Maine be able to flatten the curve? And when might some semblance of normal life return? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, the two people at the helm of Maine's COVID-19 response, Governor Janet Mills and Maine CDC Director Dr. Nirav Shah. They'll take your questions about the pandemic and the state's response. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. For Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Where does Maine stand in the fight against COVID-19? Today, we will get the latest update on the state's preparedness for a surge in cases, testing capacity, and the outlook for the weeks and months ahead. Joining me, Governor Janet Mills and Dr. Nirav Shah, Director of Maine's Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you.
As always, we want to hear from you in the audience. Do you have questions about how Maine is handling the pandemic? Do you have questions about your own family situation? I will make clear that we already have many questions coming in. If you send an email, please make it brief. You can tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Dr. Shah, the most recent numbers released just an hour ago by your office show that another person in Maine has died of COVID-19, bringing the total of 17. What can you tell us about that person?
Well, we were very saddened to learn that a woman in her 80s from Sagadahoc County recently passed away with coronavirus. Our thoughts, prayers, and condolences go out to the family of that woman and during this time of grief. Maine CDC is also reporting now a total of 586 cases of coronavirus across the state. That's an increase in 26 since yesterday. As you noted, Jennifer, there have sadly been 17 deaths. There have, however, been now 246 individuals who have recovered from their coronavirus infection, and that's an increase of 44 since yesterday.
You know, you mentioned that Maine has had 586 cases, up from 560. Those numbers they seem like big numbers, I think, to most of us, but we don't have any way to gauge them. Is that number, is today's number, 586 cases, better or worse than you feared?
Well, one way to put it is by looking in context with our neighboring state. New Hampshire currently is reporting over 800 cases. That being said, 586 cases means that 586 human beings in Maine have been affected in some way by coronavirus, and 17 of those individuals have sadly passed away. So each and every one of these cases is concerning to us. It's difficult to predict what the number could be or should be. What we know is that every case is one case too many, and so our focus right now is to try to flatten that curve to reduce the number of any new infections that occurs.
How many more people in Maine likely have COVID-19 but have not been tested? I am aware that not all the clinical diagnoses are being tracked, but you must have some way of estimating how many more people would test positive if everyone were being tested.
Well, that's a great question. And in any outbreak situation, whether it's coronavirus, influenza, measles, you name it, no matter the outbreak, what we always know is that we're only seeing a part of the iceberg. Now, how big of the iceberg we are seeing, whether it's just the tip or half of it, is difficult to estimate. And usually it's not until an outbreak is completely over and all the testing data have come in, are we ever able to say how much of the outbreak we've seen. But when we think about where we are in the outbreak and are modeling out what type of resources we might need, we use a number of different assumptions. Some of our assumptions say that we're only seeing half of the cases. Some of our assumptions only say we're only seeing a quarter of the cases. It really does vary, and it's not until after an outbreak is done and all the data are in are we then able to look back, like we can with the flu, and say at any one time how much we're seeing. It's a difficult thing to know, but what I can assure everyone is that as we are doing our planning, we're always recognizing that we're only seeing a part of the iceberg and making sure we account for that.
Governor Mills, we're having this conversation on the heels of a pretty significant April storm.
Yeah.
Many people in Maine lost power last night. This has all been very hard for a lot of people, especially those who are isolated. What words do you have for them?
Boy, patience, courage, persistence. These are tough times, and this is also a holiday weekend for many. This week commenced Passover in the Jewish religion. Today is Good Friday in the Christian religion, and Sunday, of course, is Easter. In a few weeks, folks will celebrate Ramadan, commence Ramadan. So they are faith-filled times as well as troubling times and times that test our patience. But I think the figures that Dr. Shah was just talking about also show that we are having an effect. The people of Maine are, in fact, having a positive effect on this virus and on how it spreads, whether it spreads, how fast it spreads. And it bears repeating every day, every hour, that staying at home, staying away from other people, staying apart, doing our part, is paying dividends and will continue to pay dividends. And it's pretty tough when your electricity goes out due to a surprise snowstorm like this one, and several hundred thousand people have lost power and are out of power right now. And staying at home with small children or teenagers who can't watch TV or use their computers because of an electrical outage, I just can't imagine, and I pray for all those people, too, that we survive both the pandemic and these electrical outages and come out the stronger for all that we're going through.
Can you comment on how much of a toll this is taking on Maine's economy, on individual livelihoods and jobs, and how to weigh that against the need to get ahead of the virus?
Well, I've talked with nationally known economists. I've talked with the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston and other people who are steeped in finances and economics. And I know Dr. Shah has some background in that area, too. And what everyone tells me is, if you want the economy to rebound, if you want to see this turn around and turn around in a significant way, defeat the virus. Do everything you can to defeat the virus. That is not simply a public health measure, a life-saving action, but it is part of the economic recovery, very tightly entwined with economics. In fact, the studies that the Federal Reserve Board issued 2 weeks ago about the 1918 pandemic, the so-called Spanish flu, showed that those communities which put in place non-pharmaceutical interventions like staying at home, staying out of, group carpooling and whatnot, staying away from areas where people congregate, staying apart from other people. The earlier those measures were put into place and the longer they stayed in place, the more those communities rebounded economically in three major sectors: agricultural, banking and financial institutions, and manufacturing. Now, the financial system is quite different now than it was 102 years ago, but still we can take lessons from that era and apply them to today. I envision the state of Maine rebounding significantly. I can't say when. I'm not a forecaster, but I can see our state coming back, and I have a vision of our state reinventing itself to some extent, but the hospitality industry, which has been so hard hit, it will rebound in due time, in due course. And our manufacturing base and our biopharmaceutical base will also rebound. People will want these institutions to rebound as much as ever before.
Dr. Shah, everyone got very excited about the Abbott Labs rapid tests and the prospects to begin testing more widely in Maine. You now say the number of tests will be far lower. Why is that, and what does that mean for the ability to test people in Maine?
Well, about a week ago, we at the state of Maine received word from the U.S. federal government that we would be receiving 15 of the machines, as well as enough of the chemicals to do about 2,400 of the tests. That was, of course, good news for us. That was the same amount that every other state was slated to receive as well. In some states, that's a drop in the bucket, but for us, it was going to be a game changer. Over the weekend, we then again heard from the federal government that although we would be continuing to receive the 15 machines, we would only be receiving chemicals not for 2,400 tests, but only for 120 tests. Only 5% of what they initially told us that we would be getting. This is coming straight from the U.S. federal government, not from Abbott. And we actually, the governor and I have spoken with senior executives at Abbott to make sure we got to the bottom of the story. And they indicated that the federal government is the one that's sort of quarterbacking where all of these things go. However, what we are going to be able to do with the tests that we have are two things. The first is we've already ordered additional tests. Now, when those arrive, we're not sure. Again, the federal government is right now making sure states get, or they're deciding what states get and when they get them. But we've already put in our order so that the state of Maine doesn't get bumped to the back of the line. The other thing that we are going to do is take the tests that we've got and use them for one of the highest risk populations that we know of. These are folks that could be lost to follow-up by the medical community. So folks who are experiencing homelessness, for example, to make sure that when they have symptoms, they can be rapidly diagnosed, and if they turn out to be positive, we can make sure they have a safe place to be and provide them the necessary social services.
Some of those tests have been provided to Martin's Point this week, those Abbott tests with the quick results. Are we learning anything yet from those?
Well, you know, it's I'm glad you raised that. We've learned a fair amount. Martin's Point has had a lot of experience using this type of test. In addition, I had a conversation with the senior leadership at Martin's Point about 48 hours ago in recognition of the fact that they had received a fair number of these tests. Now, I want to be clear, Martin's Point did not ask for these. They were just delivered to them. And in recognition of the fact that we at the state of Maine got a lot less than what the federal government initially told us we were going to get, I asked Martin's Point if they would be willing to collaborate with us. And they have agreed to give us five of their test kits, effectively doubling the state's capacity to run these rapid tests. And I just want to take a moment to thank our colleagues at Martin's Point and just shine a spotlight on this great example of collaboration between the state and the healthcare system. And we are deeply, deeply grateful for Martin's Point for at least right now doubling our ability to run these tests.
Governor Mills, what is the status of the overflow treatment facilities being set up in Portland and Bangor, and when do you believe they will be ready if they are needed?
We're working on that right now, and I'll be talking to Peter Rogers a little later this afternoon to see what the status of those setups is. We've activated some National Guard folks and been talking to the cross centers, across both cross centers, addressing the staff issues and whom to deploy how. So I don't have a final plan to offer you right this minute. It's a work in progress.
To both of you, I wanted to ask, why is Maine preserving the confidentiality around the numbers of deaths at different nursing homes and senior living communities when some other states have been disclosing those numbers?
Actually, we disclosed some data regarding the location of some of the people who passed away, I think. But generally speaking, we've been conferring with the Attorney General's office and others, and we think that it's so easy to identify people from their location that that's probably not a fair thing to do under HIPAA, not a legal thing to do under HIPAA, and we're being pretty cautious about people's privacy.
All right, I want to go to a question from an email from Vernon. What is the difference between 14-day self-quarantine orders for people who come to Maine from out of state and stay-at-home orders for the rest of the population of Maine? Are we dealing with semantics, or are there different limitations? And if there are different limitations, what are they?
Oh, good question. That's a great question. Self-quarantine means don't go out. Don't go out at all. The stay-at-home order has some exceptions for hiking and walking the dog and buying groceries. When people are coming from out of states, first of all, we've said nobody should come here if they're exhibiting symptoms of COVID-19. Second of all, if they come here even without symptoms, we're asking them to quarantine out of an excess of caution, perhaps, but just stay where you are for 14 days. Do not go out and buy groceries. Do not mingle with anybody at the stores or down on the playground or at public park or anywhere else. Stay where you are. That's the difference. I think a quarantine is a little harsher. It's more restrictive. That's the short answer.
All right. I want to go to another question from Facebook. This is from Sharon. She writes, I am a public health physician and have worked with many international outbreaks. I believe that the U.S. CDC and Maine CDC should adopt the WHO COVID-19 case definitions and use a category for reporting suspect cases and not just confirmed cases. In a time of such limited testing, we can at least respond to clinical symptoms and validate people. This could allow more clear guidance for the public about quarantine and isolation. In the hopefully near future, we would be ready for testing of those suspect cases. Could Dr. Shaw tell us if the Maine CDC would consider this?
Well, we've certainly taken a look at that, and we typically follow and take our cues in these situations from the U.S. CDC. Part of the reason there is so that, and all states do that, part of the reason for that is to make sure that when we report numbers, the U.S. CDC knows exactly what we're reporting, so we maintain that consistency. What the U.S. CDC has decided to do and what other states have adopted is a definition that basically says if you're not feeling well, and you've got the signs and symptoms of coronavirus, and you are in an area where coronavirus is known to be circulating, such as the state of Maine, you are presumed to have coronavirus, and physicians will treat you that way, meaning they'll ask you to stay inside. They'll ask you to make sure to avoid limiting contact with others, and make sure that if you get sick, you call the doctor and try to get back in. Earlier on in the outbreak, when testing was a little bit less certain, we did have a category of the so-called presumptive positives. But now that the quality and the speed of testing has improved, we've removed that category so that any time any laboratory in the state of Maine or elsewhere returns a test, the U.S. FDA has said we believe in the fidelity of that test. And so if it says it's positive, it's positive. And so as a result of that, we remove that category from our website, as have other states, that so-called presumptive positive category, because we've got faith in the way that the test is being run now.
We'll go to Charlie, who's calling from South Portland. Hi, Charlie. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Yeah, my question is for Jen Mills. A lot of us small business owners have been struggling with a lockdown. I own a surf shop, Maine Surfers Union, in Portland, Maine. As you know, Portland's been locked down as one of the first places. And the SBA loans have been, unfortunately, more geared towards bigger businesses and not so small mom-and-pop shops, including the PPP loan. And I'm just wondering if Maine would be interested in doing something more geared toward its small businesses with a Maine loan and working with Maine financial institutions instead of just going through the SBA loan, which has been giving a lot of small businesses headaches to try to get or even get.
Yes, thank you so much. And I am so sorry for what you're going through. Honestly, it's just you're in the same boat with many, many others, if that's any comfort. The legislature, in the emergency bill that we helped, that we drafted and they enacted barely a month ago, did enact a small business loan program that's going through FAME, the Finance Authority of Maine. They're geared up to do that, I believe, now. If you check online with FAME, I suppose it's fame.maine, I'm not sure, but Finance Authority of Maine, they may well have some funds that might be helpful to you and businesses of your size to help you weather this storm and hopefully come out the other side as vibrant and as active as ever. And we want you back. We want you to be back in business as soon as possible. In the meantime, obviously, we're continuing to enforce the public-facing restrictions of all businesses pretty much. Thank you so much for your patience.
Charlie, thank you for your call today. We'll move on to Kirk, who's calling from Bristol. Hi, Kirk. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'd just like to thank Governor Mills and Dr. Shaw. I think that you're doing an excellent job. And I know it's tough for everybody to be locked down, but I think clearly the numbers are showing that it's the right thing to do. And just to briefly address the previous caller, I work from home, fortunately, and I work for a nationwide bank. And I know that they have been getting more information by the day from the federal government. And so they're trying to roll out the federal programs as quickly as possible. I think a little bit of patience may pay off, but it's a big time of everything in flux right now, and I just think that Maine's doing the right thing, and thank you.
That's a great point. Thank you, Kurt. And I should have clarified, the SBA loans that Charles was referring to are undoubtedly the loans that came out of the CARES Act a week and a half ago, and those loans are for businesses to keep making payroll until June 30th. 75% of the money from those loans goes to make payroll, and 25% for other overheads such as rent or utilities. And if the money is used for those purposes through June 30th, at that point it becomes a grant. That's different than the loans that the state that we set up at the state level in the last couple of weeks, but both are potentially available to businesses.
Kirk, thanks so much for your call. Governor Mills, where does the state's rainy day fund stand?
It is at $257 million, as it was a month ago. we have not dipped into the state's rainy day fund. We have used monies especially appropriated by the legislature to address the COVID-19 crisis. We've used that, and the CDC has been using that to do what they do for testing and personnel and whatnot, and that's where that stands. The rainy day fund has not been touched.
All right, we will move to Elaine calling from Reedfield. Hi, Elaine, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question is for the doctor. It's been my understanding that the hospitals in New York City are using the malarial drug plus the Z-Pak cocktail as pretty much standard procedure. So I was wondering if that was being done in Maine and if you are collecting the data on the efficacy of this.
Sure, Elaine. Dr. Shaw?
Well, that's a great question. We've received a lot of questions about this malaria drug, hydroxychloroquine. And it's a great question because it really gets to the heart of what scientists and medical scientists do. There's a good question out there about whether this drug is effective, whether it's safe, and if it is effective, in which patients it might be the most effective. And like all scientific questions right now, research is needed before we've got an answer. There have been a couple of glimmers of hope on the horizon that the malaria drug in concert with other drugs might be effective. There have also been some signs that show that it actually is a pretty toxic drug and can harm people as well. So as with all scientific questions, to be completely candid with you, we've got to wait until all the scientific data are in. For that reason, and at this time, Maine CDC and the U.S. CDC are neither recommending in favor or against the drug. Clinicians, based on their own clinical expertise and judgment, might decide to use the drug, and if so, we're hoping that they do so as part of a clinical study so that more data can be generated that will ultimately help other people down the road.
Elaine, thanks so much for your question. We have an email from David. We live in Rockland and are concerned about the smaller cruise ships that are scheduled to arrive. The U.S. CDC has banned ships over 250 people, but there are a number of smaller ships that are coming to Rockland. Will the state step up and ban those as well?
Good question. Well, we are, first of all, waiting for renewed U.S. CDC guidance. I understand they're coming out with renewed guidance on their no-sail policy right now. We're expecting that shortly. We will be happy to look at smaller cruise ships as things progress in the next few weeks. I have not taken any action yet on that issue, but thank you for bringing it to my attention. I appreciate that.
All right, Stephen on Facebook writes, my sister works in a nursing home who is denying masks to staff at work. Even though there is not the same level of disease and trauma as hospitals, is there a recommendation for protecting staff as well as patients with the use of masks and other precautions? If facilities refuse to provide or allow basic practices and precautions that we're seeing nationwide, is there an authority for families or staff to contact for help?
Good question.
Well, one place to start is by noting that one of the concerns that Maine CDC has had since the beginning of our work is on long-term care facilities, specifically nursing homes. We know that those are settings where a lot of folks can be in an enclosed space, and they're often folks who are more vulnerable. They can be older or medically brittle. And so one of the reasons that early on, after we saw what happened in Seattle, King County, Maine CDC started working really closely with long-term care facilities to make sure they knew all the scientific data, had the latest on infection control practices, as well as to fulfill any requests they've had for PPE. I can't comment on any particular institution, and certainly if any employee has concerns, we would urge them to call their respective Department of Labor or representative there. But what Maine CDC has been doing is, in recognition of the unique risk that individuals in those facilities have, we've started working with long-term care as well as the professional association of those facilities to equip operators, nurses, physicians who practice there with the latest information. They really are one of our top priorities right now.
Governor Mills, I understand you have to leave us now. I appreciate you making a half hour for Maine Calling and our audience questions.
Thank you very much, Jennifer, and see you on the radio.
And we are going to take a quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions for Dr. Nirav Shah of Maine CDC. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Evergreen Home Performance, helping homeowners address climate change with energy audits, window replacement, and insulation. More at evergreenyourhome.com. And Cumberland Crossing by Ocean View, a new retirement cottage community proudly supporting Saturday Afternoon Opera, which airs tomorrow on Maine Public Classical.
COVID-19 has changed daily life in the U.S., and with news breaking by the hour, it can be hard to stay up to date. I'm Ari Shapiro. Join us every weekday for a new live conversation about the disease, what you need to know, what's coming next, and we'll answer your questions. The National Conversation with All Things Considered, live every weekday at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 Pacific, from NPR News.
And that's coming up this evening at 9 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. Trusted news, quality entertainment, and lifelong learning is what Maine Public Television is all about, four channels strong. We've made some adjustments to provide more daytime educational fare, from science to history programming for the older kids who find themselves home during this time of social distancing. We have the PBS Kids channel for preschool children, but our main channel just added more afternoon programming for older learners, starting now at 1:30 each afternoon. And the Maine Public World channel is now doing the same each weekday afternoon from 12 to 5. Television programming that is worthwhile and educational to watch. See the schedule for our Maine HD and World channels at mainepublic.org. Click on the television drop-down.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we have Dr. Nirav Shah of Maine CDC here today to talk about the latest on the coronavirus pandemic in Maine. You can email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Here's an email from Mark. Is there any significant statistical difference in the death rate because of COVID-19 compared to the so-called regular bad winter deaths of Maine between December and April, either here or across the U.S., or will we know after the fact if there is a difference?
It's a good question, and the answer is a little bit of both. So certainly the deaths that we've seen are deaths that are not in keeping with what we would have normally seen. But again, as with a lot of outbreak-related epidemic data, you don't really have a full picture of what happened until you've driven through the storm and are looking back at it. But what we really do know is that any death attributable to COVID-19 is one death too many. That's why, for example, we're really focusing our efforts on places like long-term care facilities to keep all of those folks safe. But that really is our top priority right now, and it's a good question.
What is a typical death rate for a flu season in Maine?
So the typical death rate overall for the flu, it hovers on the order of about, it really does vary by population group, but it can be on the order of about 0.1 to 0.3% of those who get the flu might actually pass away. With COVID-19, again, the numbers are still coming in, But COVID-19 could be anywhere from 5 to 10 times more deadly than the flu. Some estimates have it even higher. What we know is that, again, no matter what the exact number turns out to be, COVID-19 is far more serious than the flu, partly because it leads to more people passing away, but also because it's far more easily spread from person to person. When you layer on top of that the fact that no one has any immunity to it whatsoever, unlike the flu where you can get a flu shot, it really is the mix of the ingredients of a perfect storm.
I'm going to read two related posts here. One is an email from Nick. Nick writes, I would think that a few weeks or months of practical training would not only supply a large, useful army of volunteers to assist nurses and doctors, etc., but also give them a sense of purpose. Not everyone needs to be a certified medical professional in these times to lend assistance. And then from Larry, I'm a former surgery tech. At my Air Force base, I was the Friday emergency room person. I'm a damn good medic. All minor surgery was done by me. Triage was done by me. I'm a 100% disabled vet. That was 55 years ago, but now I hear Governor Cuomo pleading for help. It's killing me. I know I can help. I'm a very good medic. Dr. Shaw, do you foresee any time in the near future in which people who are not already on the front lines might need to be relieved or aided by those who want to step up and help?
It's a possibility. It is a possibility, and it's a possibility that we've planned for. What I would ask both of those individuals to do, the folks who are willing to get on the front lines and anyone out there who would like to volunteer, I would urge everyone to go to Maine Responds. You can Google it or go to mainresponds.org and register there to serve as a volunteer. It's a bit of a lengthy questionnaire because we really want to know exactly what your skills are, what your licensure status is, and where, if needed, we might ask you to deploy to. And as we see the situation evolving in different parts of the state, we have a full-time coordinator, a gentleman whose full-time job it is to match the needs of particular areas of the state with the supply of individuals like these two folks who want to volunteer. I think more than anything, this speaks to the character of folks in Maine who want to help, and this is a square and concrete way for them to do so.
We have an email from Steve. You're a wonderful example of a great leader and public servant. Thank you. When do you anticipate we will have an accurate and widely usable antibody test? Seems that it will be the key to getting folks safely back to their jobs. Well, also, could you use help in moving in the lab, moving tests along, or an extra gumshoe? I'm thinking of registering with the Maine Responds as a volunteer in the Maine Medical Reserve Corps. So what can you tell us about an antibody test and, again, volunteering in the way that Steve is interested?
Well, so Steve, first of all, thank you for your comments. Now, the antibody test is an area of high interest. What that is there are two ways to run a test to see if someone has COVID-19 or a lot of other diseases. One is to look for the bacteria or the virus itself, and that's right now the way that all of the testing is done in the United States. We use a sophisticated set of machines that look for the DNA fingerprint in the sample that we look at. Another way to test for any kind of virus or bacteria is to look for the signs of the body's own defense. We all know that our bodies are marvelous machines at healing ourselves. And they do that by generating their own antibodies against specific viruses. And we can look for those as well to see if someone has been exposed. As Steve notes, that antibody test is really the next big thing that's coming down the pike. There has been at least one that's been approved by the FDA and quite a few others that are in the pipeline. I've actually had the privilege of speaking with a senior executive at one of the largest diagnostic companies in the world to ask that person this exact question: when can we have reliable antibody testing? And unfortunately, this individual indicated that it's been a pretty difficult scientific challenge. So it may not be for a month or two before we have that. Now, Steve, your other question is about ways that you could volunteer with Maine CDC. And here I want to take a moment to thank my staff. It's actually National Public Health Week this week, as it turns out. And the team at Maine CDC has been working yeomen's hours. We have people that are now doing two, in some cases three jobs, But our lab staff in particular deserve a shout out. They have been able so far to keep up with the demand for testing. They're working 7 days a week running COVID-19 specimens so doctors out in the field can get results and treat patients. Right now, our lab staff has got what they need. What I would ask everyone to do is, again, to sign up. And then if you know somebody that works in the lab, especially at the main CDC lab, give them a fist bump.
All right. We'll go to Naples and Tracy. Hi, Tracy. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Hi, yes. Thank you so much for these daily shows. They're vitally important. But what I'd like to ask is, what is the data finding from after people that have the severe respiratory symptoms, be it on or off a ventilator? Is there severe lung damage or are people fully recovering?
It's a great question. Right now, the data are coming in. So you're specifically asking about folks who are pretty sick. Folks who have had to be in the hospital and, as you mentioned, maybe even have had to have been on a ventilator. And so we don't really have a good picture of what the long-term effects of having had COVID-19 disease are, especially if you've had to have been on a ventilator. But what we do know in general is that for viruses like COVID-19, there can be, in some cases, long-term effects on the lungs. Someone who was a really avid athlete before may find that it takes a long time to get back up to the level of, say, running that they were able to before. What that looks like specifically, there's still a lot of data that's being generated. But if COVID-19 behaves like other viruses, we won't be surprised if there are, for some people, some long-term consequences.
Tracy, thank you for your question. A related question, this is an email from Holly. Many people are at home when they fall ill and recover from the coronavirus. What does a normal recovery from a mild case look like? My sister, age 74, had all the classic symptoms of the virus and is now symptom-free except for weakness and a cough when speaking. She is unable to take a deep breath in and hold it for a few seconds without coughing. I am worried that she may have pneumonia, but perhaps the coughing is due to a reactive airway. What symptoms are part of a normal recovery, and what symptoms should cause alarm?
Well, that's a great question, and I'm glad your sister is feeling a bit better. That's a positive sign. As you note, about 80% of people who have coronavirus, their symptoms are mild and resolve on their own, in most cases without even needing to go to a doctor. Now, that's cold comfort for the 20% of people who have severe symptoms and may need to go to the doctor and be hospitalized. But for that 80%, what we know is that it can be several days. It can take up to maybe 2 weeks before their symptoms completely resolve. And kind of what we were talking about with the other question, with the other caller, what the long-term effects are not quite yet known. Now, there doesn't seem to be any data to suggest that once you've recovered, you're able to pass it to anybody else. So far, once you're recovered, you're recovered. But whether there might be a bit of a lingering cough or a little bit of weakness that might persist for a longer period of time, that's still something that the scientific community is looking into. But what I want to say is that I wish your sister the best in her recovery journey.
We'll go to Rob, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Rob. Go ahead.
Yes, hello. Thank you very much. And Dr. Shah, thank you very much for your work and your colleagues. Quick question is, if somebody's been diagnosed with COVID-19, has been symptomatic for about 10 days and then resolves, how long can we assume that they're not shedding any viruses that they might cause other individuals to contract COVID-19?
Well, that's a great question. And I want to separate out a couple of things. The first is, what do we mean when we say someone has recovered? When we post that up on our website, what are we actually saying there? And the definition of recovered is a pretty specific one that we at the main CDC follow. It's actually the U.S. CDC's definition. And it involves working with a main CDC disease detective who checks in with every confirmed case. And that epidemiologist makes the determination in accordance with the guidelines about when people's symptoms have resolved in a certain fashion that they can be classified as recovered. What we know based on some international data is that even after someone has been recovered, it's still possible that they might shed a little bit of the virus. But the definition of recovered was set because it acknowledges that even though you might shed just a little bit of virus, it's probably not enough to infect anybody else. There's always viruses around us, everywhere in our life. There are viruses on every surface we touch, in every molecule of air we breathe. The question is whether the dose of any of those viruses is enough to cause any kind of disease in somebody else. And the U.S. CDC definition was set with the recognition that if there is a little bit of virus that people are still having come out of their body, it's probably not high enough to cause any kind of illness. There's nothing certain right now, and so these things are always being revisited, and that's based on what we know right now.
We are going to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your questions for Dr. Nirav Shah. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Maine Masonic Charitable Foundation, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine. And the Lunder Foundation, in support of the Colby College Museum of Art, always free and open to all. On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
On April 10, 1837, the Maine Institute of Natural Science welcomed its first speaker, Dr. Charles T. Jackson, Maine's first state geologist. The Institute later became the Portland Natural History Society and then ultimately the Maine Audubon Society. Connected to these early organizations, the Maine Audubon Society is very likely the oldest citizens' organization dedicated to the natural sciences in the United States. Today, as the largest Maine-based wildlife conservation organization, Maine Audubon has 8 wildlife sanctuaries.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of Roosevelt Campobello International Park and the Island Institute. Happy birthday, Maine! The Maine Centers for Disease Control holds a daily briefing on the coronavirus for the citizens of Maine. We'll carry it here on Maine Public Radio, but you can also watch it in its entirety on Maine Public Television, on our website, mainepublic.org, and on the Maine Public Facebook page. Today's briefing is scheduled later than usual. It's at 2:30 this afternoon, and Governor Mills is scheduled to attend. Again, today's daily briefing on the coronavirus from the Maine CDC with Dr. Shah and Governor Mills is scheduled for 2:30 this afternoon. It will also be archived for on-demand viewing at mainepublic.org. Click on the television drop-down.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling, and we're talking with Dr. Nirav Shah about how COVID-19 is affecting people in Maine. We're going to go to Becky in Westbrook. Hi, Becky. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. First of all, thank you, Dr. Shah, for all your hard work. I'm a school nurse in the Portland area, so we all appreciate what you're doing. My question is around what Governor Andrew Cuomo had said today about that he's setting up a coalition between the New Jersey, New York, and Connecticut in the tri-state area to work on getting more aggressive testing done and to be able to do that because of certainly they're in a hot spot. But I wonder if setting up a coalition like that for Maine to either join or become part of to have easier access to the testing supplies. And I'll take the answer offline. Thanks.
Well, thanks, Becky, and thank you for all you're doing. School nurses and school-based health centers are a really vital part of our public health infrastructure. And you raise a great question about testing and the overall availability of testing. I think New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, just from an epidemiological perspective, are in a different place from Maine and New Hampshire. Their rate of cases, their number of cases, and the strain that they're facing on their healthcare system are markedly different than what we are experiencing here. And so even though I have pretty frequent conversations several times per week with my counterparts all across the Northeast, right now the testing capacity in Maine is such that at least at the Maine CDC laboratory, we've been able to keep up with the daily demand for tests. To put it differently, there's currently no backlog of any tests at the Maine CDC laboratory. But our job in public health, as you know, is to worry about things in advance. And so one of the things that we are thinking about is if there were to be a surge in cases or the surge in demand for testing, how would we accommodate that? And we've worked with a number of commercial laboratories to have backup surge capacity, as well as with some of our other colleagues up here in New England to have sort of a collaborative so that if there were a surge in demand for testing, we could potentially share testing resources with one another or even send specimens from one state to another if one state experienced that surge.
Becky, thanks for your question. A question from Marty on Facebook. What is the plan for dealing with cases in the areas with smaller hospitals, like in Washington and Aroostook counties, where there are no intensive care units?
That is a great question, and it's something, again, that we've been concerned about and thinking about. To go back to the numbers, just for a moment, about 80% of folks who have COVID-19 don't even need to go to a doctor at all. Their symptoms self-resolve. But for that 20% who do, many of those individuals could be taken care of in a hospital outside of an intensive care setting. However, we also know that a certain fraction of patients who have to be hospitalized need intensive care and may even need to be on a ventilator. So for that, we're working with some of the hospital systems, actually all of the hospital systems across Maine, as well as our colleagues in the EMS system, to make sure that there are robust linkages between those smaller regional hospitals and larger hospitals and larger cities so that if patients need to be transferred, that the EMS professionals who are really on the front lines of the front lines, that they've got everything they need to do to make sure those transfers go safely and smoothly.
We're going to go to a question that came in earlier this morning from Gary. I'm looking for a marker or bookend that suggests that normalcy has returned. My thought is that when I can get a haircut from a barber, it marks a significant change. Many businesses were closed at once by Governor Mills' orders. Are these businesses likely to be allowed to open at once, or will there be a rollout based on acceptable risks?
Well, Gary, that's a good question. It's one that I think about probably more than any other right now. And here's how I think about it. We got to where we are in this stage of our response to the outbreak by climbing a very steep set of stairs. We didn't just jump to the top step that we're on right now, closing down every business that's non-essential, closing down hotels, et cetera. We didn't just jump to that top step. We got there in a responsible way by going in a stepwise fashion. In that same manner, we'll probably walk back down the stairs in a similarly stepwise fashion. So there's not a giant switch on the wall that one day we'll decide to flip and everything will be back to normal, as much as I might like that to be the case. It will probably happen in waves in the same way that we found ourselves here, by following the data, by following recommendations from public health practitioners and clinical experts. We'll do the same thing, but somewhat in reverse order, by looking at the data on the number of new cases, looking at data on hospitals' ability to care for people without a surge, by looking at data on testing availability broadly. When we start seeing those signs on the horizon, that's when we'll start climbing back down the stairs.
We'll go to Diane, who's calling from Emden. Hi, Diane, go ahead.
Hi, Dr. Shaw. I want to reiterate everyone's thanks for your tireless efforts and your excellent communication back to those of us across the state. My question has to do with the reliability of the tests, I guess, that we have now, as well as if we actually get these rapid point-of-care tests available in the community health centers where I work. Can we trust them with a high degree of certainty so that if we say you don't have it and we take off our protective gear or don't put it on, we're really going to be okay and the patient really does not have the disease?
That is an exceptionally good question. I can't begin to tell you how great of a question that is and how much our team has been discussing that. And so here's the bottom line, and I'm going to give it to you straight because it's a great question. If a test is sent to our laboratory or to one of the commercial laboratories that does the PCR, or the genetic fingerprint-based test, those results are extremely reliable. A negative means a negative, and a positive means a positive. For the more rapid point-of-care tests that are made by other diagnostic manufacturers, the straight answer is that it's too early to tell. those tests were approved by the FDA under an emergency authorization. One of the things that my lab team and I were actually talking about last night and this morning is running our own mini study to see how the rapid machine compares against the gold standard, the DNA machine, and trying to get a better handle on that exact question. The one thing that I will note is that a lot of this depends on how well the swab is taken. And if you've ever had your nasal passage swab for this, you know it's actually pretty invasive. It feels like the Q-tip is touching your brain. And a lot of people don't want to go that far up into someone's nose. And so a lot of this depends on training operators to make sure they're getting that swab as far up into the nose as it needs to go. Great question, and it's something that we're thinking a lot about.
Diane, thank you for your question. Going to try to squeeze in one or two more. This is from Cheryl, an email. Are you tracking the race and income data of coronavirus patients? This is crucial information to inform interventions at the public health and community level. I am interested particularly in the Native American and immigrant communities in Maine.
Absolutely. So health equity is really central to everything that we do in public health, whether it's an outbreak situation, a pandemic, or not. And so we are, of course, deeply troubled by some recent data that the U.S. CDC published on the disproportionate impact of COVID-19 on African-American populations. We're tracking those same data in Maine right now, but in the same way that it took some of those other cities several thousands of cases before they were able to draw any distinct conclusions, as was the case in Illinois, we don't really have enough data in Maine right now to be able to draw any conclusions, but we are tracking those data to try to see if there's a socioeconomic impact. And based on everything we know in public health, it's likely the case that there may be.
Very quickly, an email from Liliana, wondering if it's possible for hospitals to provide information to the Maine CDC about the amount of PPE they have, their staff training, and their preparation of negative pressure rooms, etc. Some context, my spouse is a healthcare provider working for a respiratory specialty clinic located in one of the big hospitals in Maine, and they have not received information or training.
Well, one of the things I'm able to report is that every single day, every single hospital across Maine reports in to the Maine CDC their availability of all of these vital assets, whether it's the number of respirators that are available, the number of ICU beds that are free, the number of respiratory therapists who are available and staffed and ready to go. Those numbers are reported into Maine CDC live every single day. And that gives us a bird's eye view into everything that's going on. One of those numbers that we've also started tracking is the amount of PPE as well. That way, when a hospital makes a request of us, as have many hospitals, we can load balance across the state. I recognize how hard it is for hospitals to do this reporting, and I really just want to take a moment to thank them for giving us these data to give us visibility into what's going on.
All right. Well, my last Facebook post is a comment and not a question. This is from Peter. I am the chief of medical services and lead hospitalist at a Maine critical access hospital. I simply want to thank Dr. Shaw for his impressive leadership at this critical and unique time for Maine, our country, and really the entire planet. Competent, transparent, compassionate, and humane. Bravo.
Well, that's very thoughtful. And, you know, Jennifer, I think, first of all, it's certainly not about me. But, you know, what I think is a lot more important is that comment says a lot more about the spirit and the character of Maine people than anything else. It shows me that a guy from another state with a different name who's only been here for 10 months, that I could be accepted by people in Maine and come to be a trusted source of information, that says a lot more about the character of people in Maine than it does anything else.
Maine CDC Director Dr. Nirav Shah, thank you so much for being on Maine Calling. And indeed, at 2:30, we will be holding your daily press briefing live on radio, television, and the internet. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.